Welcome to another episode of the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Chris Hemmelman, pastor of First City Church, and I am here with Bob Thune, pastor of Coram Deo Church. On Wednesdays, we sit down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today, we're talking about the death of a seminary.
That is the first intro you've ever done on the Wednesday Conversation.
That was kind of fun.
After 500 episodes.
I know. I should have been able to do that in my sleep.
Amazing. Dusty White will be joining us late. He's coming in from another engagement, and we are talking about a piece of headline news that came across last week, and that is that Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, also known as TEDS for short, or Trinity Seminary, in Deerfield, Illinois, is closing down its Chicago campus and technically moving to British Columbia to join with Trinity Western University, which is an evangelical free church college in Canada. But functionally, what that means is the United States is losing a flagship seminary.
Yeah. How many people from the U.S. are going to go to Canada for seminary?
Right. Not a whole lot, I don't think. So this is bad news, sad news for American Protestant Christianity. It's a bummer. TEDS, as we will call it on this podcast, has been a hugely influential seminary in actually world Christianity, and it has been a key institution for American Christian influence for a long time. Why are we talking about this? Obviously, Chris and I are pastors. We interact with seminaries frequently. But even if you're just a listener who's not in ministry and you're just a Christian listening to this podcast, I want you to care about the flourishing of the church and theological education is one of the primary necessities for the flourishing of the church. History proves that. The American experiment proves that. And so I want you to care when theological education starts to suffer. That should matter to you as a Christian. In fact, this cause is bound up with the founding of our country. Harvard, Yale, Princeton, these were all originally training schools for pastors. And so America has a rich history of theological education being central to the work of the local church. The other reason I want you to care as a listener is because institutions matter. So the death of a major institution in American Christianity should have interest to you as you pray for the church, as you think about how to invest your dollars, and as you hope to see future pastors trained for ministry. We've talked a lot on this podcast about sort of the death of institutions. There's an anti-institutional sort of vibe in our moment right now, and a lot of institutions that used to sort of shore up American life are being disintegrated. I mean, just think about your local newspaper and how different it is right now from what it was 20 or 30 years ago. Think about your local library. Think about, you know, clubs like the Kiwanis Club or the Lions Club and so forth. We've talked a lot about how a lot of these mediating institutions are fading away. And in this case, an important seminary that has played a key role in American Christianity.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but this seems to be a trend that seminaries are struggling.
It is absolutely a trend. In fact, I think there's a quote later on here. Fuller Seminary and Gordon Conwell have both had similar struggles over the past 5 years or so.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's probably multiple reasons for this. I think that was one of the, when I first heard you mention this, it was like, TEDS just seems like such an institution. You think of all the places that would struggle. It wouldn't be someone with a place with such prominence, but you know, Fuller, Gordon Conwell, those are also prominent places too. So no one is immune.
Sidebar, we don't do sponsorships on this podcast, but this actually, I do want to do a little advertisement here for the Coram Deo Church Pastoral Residency Program.
Ooh, there you go.
Because one of the things seminaries exist to do is to train future pastors. And one of the gaps in that training is the fact that seminaries are academic institutions and they are not local churches. And so we have worked hard over the past few years to refine and tighten up our pastoral residency program, and we do have a fully compensated 2-year pastoral residency. This is intended for a man who has already received some theological education, or at least already begun, and is looking for sort of the opportunity to, it's just like a medical residency, where the idea is come practice alongside some doctors on your way to becoming a doctor. This idea is come practice alongside some pastors in a local church on your way to becoming a pastor. If you have interest in hearing more about that, you can email podcast@cudomaha.com and just ask for info about the pastoral residency. Chris, you did it like 10 years ago.
I mean, I would recommend it to anyone. Yes.
Worked out
yes.
for you. And that was even yeah. back before it was even as refined as it is now.
Yeah. It was a great year, a great experience.
That's kind of you. Well, let me read from the headline or from some of the, I gathered a bunch of news articles off the internet about the demise of this seminary. And I want to read what happened to Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. Enrollment has been declining in recent years. Back in 2000, Trinity had 1,402 students. For the past school year, it had 813 students, and not all of those were full-time. And so that's a significant decline in student enrollment. The university ran a $17.3 million deficit in 2023. Hard to do business when you're losing $17 million a year. Trinity's 2024 audit shows a $7 million deficit with a similar deficit expected this year. So it obviously was facing both declining enrollment and significant costs. Now, it did have a beautiful campus. And so I think this is part of what Trinity had that was impressive was this beautiful campus north of Chicago that was a destination spot. It was a great campus. I've been there, and it was beautiful and well-appointed. And so I think they faced the reality that a lot of institutions do, where if you do not have the income to sustain the outlay that you're making in infrastructure, you get upside down real fast. I want to help you understand the backstory of Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, because it's actually a really interesting story of how the Lord has worked over 100 years here. Bill Kynes, who's an acquaintance of mine, serves on the Gospel Coalition Council with me, wrote an article just a couple years ago at TGC sort of giving the backstory of Trinity Seminary. And I wanted to, maybe Chris, if you could read a couple of these paragraphs directly from his article, that would help us sort of just understand the story here.
Trinity was birthed in 1897 as a 10-week Bible course held in the basement of a church to train workers for the Swedish Evangelical Free Church. From that humble beginning, the school took on various forms and emerged in the early 1960s as Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, under the leadership of Kenneth Cancer, who served as dean from 1960 to 1978. Cancer was one of the leading architects of the new evangelical movement, which guided theologically conservative Christians away from fundamentalism's cultural and intellectual isolation. He believed a seminary could combine robust biblical orthodoxy with gospel piety, evangelistic zeal, cultural engagement, and academic excellence. Those are good values right there.
That is. And Cancer's vision was compelling. Trinity soon became one of the largest seminaries in America. Ed Stetzer, in another article, said it was often referred to as the queen of the seminaries. I mean, this place had a significant heft. Here are some key graduates. And if you've done any work reading a commentary or reading a book of apologetics, you've probably heard some of these names. William Lane Craig, Craig Blomberg, Walt Kaiser, Scott McKnight, Doug Moo, Mark Knoll, David Wells, all of these authors and leaders graduated from Trinity. Some of the key faculty who have taught there include D.A. Carson, Wayne Grudem, Norm Geisler, Gleason Archer, and Kevin Van Hooser. That's kind of a who's who of American evangelicalism over the last
significant names
40 years. So this Trinity has had a significant impact on American Christianity. What happened recently over the past couple of years kind of mirrors what has happened at Gordon-Conwell just a couple of years ago. I found in my research a piece written by a former president of Gordon-Conwell in 2022. So Gordon-Conwell has a beautiful campus north of Boston, and 2 years ago they decided to sell off a significant portion of that campus and sort of consolidate and relocate, because when your institution is suffering, the first thing you do is sell off some property, because it's a good way to raise capital. And however, whatever institutions are doing this, it's usually a bad sign. If your seminary is starting to sell off campus, that's usually not a good thing. But I want to read three paragraphs, or the first couple opening paragraphs from this little essay from the former president of Gordon-Conwell. He writes, "Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary recently announced its intent to sell most, if not all, of its 102-acre campus in South Hamilton, Massachusetts, in order to try to survive financially." Remember, he's writing this in 2022. "This would have been unthinkable even 15 years ago. I know, because 15 years ago, I was its president. A lot can happen in that length of time. Gordon-Conwell's enrollment plummeted from 1,230 full-time equivalent students in 2012 to 633 in 2021. When I assumed full fiduciary responsibility as president in 2006, I learned that we needed to raise $1 million before year end to meet the budget. That challenge apparently only grew over time, as tax records show that from 2016 to 2019, the school consistently faced a year-end deficit between $600,000 and $2.4 million. So again, that's the story of Gordon Conwell, but I assume that something similar was happening at Trinity, where year over year they're running a deficit and it just becomes hard to sustain that reality financially. And the simplest and quickest way to solve that problem is to sell off property and or, in the worst case, close your institution. So the question you might have as a listener is, okay, is this a trend? I mean, is there a broader problem here in theological education where seminaries are closing? You might hear a lot about Christian colleges, just the decline in college enrollment because there are just less 18-year-olds right now than there were 10 years ago. And so demographically, people are saying, hey, some colleges aren't going to make it because there's just not enough students. And so you may wonder, hey, same thing happening with seminaries. Is that, you know, is this just part of the decline of students? Well, actually, not the case. Here's interesting stats from the from ATS, which is the Association of Theological Schools. That's the accrediting body that accredits seminaries in America. According to ATS, there are 74,000 seminary students in the U.S. That's across Protestant, Roman Catholic, Orthodox, and Jewish graduate schools. So those four traditions combined, 74,000 seminary students. ATS reported that total enrollment in fall 2024 across the reporting seminaries was up by almost 2% over fall 2023. So enrollment is up, but here's the tricky stat. 55% of the schools reported year-over-year increases, while 45% reported decreases. We'll come back to that in a minute. Interestingly, evangelical seminaries are the largest in the country. Liberty Theological Seminary, which is Baptist, but is not one of the official Southern Baptist seminaries, is the largest with over 6,000 students enrolled. All six of the Southern Baptist denominational seminaries are in the top 10. That would be Southern Seminary in Louisville, Midwestern in Kansas City, Southwestern in Fort Worth, Southeastern in North Carolina, Gateway in San Francisco, and New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary in New Orleans. Others in the top 25 include Dallas Theological Seminary, Fuller Seminary, Talbot, where my dad went, Gordon Conwell, Denver, Masters Seminary, Western Seminary, Moody, and Columbia Biblical Seminary. Chris, your and my alma mater, Reformed Theological Seminary, is number 16.
16? Okay.
It's pretty good.
Yeah.
Interestingly, Duke Divinity School is the only mainline seminary in the top 25.
Okay.
So what you see is the evangelical schools tend to be the biggest. The only mainline seminary that cracks the top 25 is Duke.
And that's not necessarily because of it being more elite either, is it?
I don't think so. I don't actually know. It's a good question.
Yeah. Because I swear I read something somewhere where someone was making the point that it's actually easier to get into Duke than it's ever been because they actually need more students. Yeah. I don't know how much that plays a role, but my guess is that it's probably not why.
That would not surprise me. So what that all means is that seminary education in America is actually doing fine. What's happening is the big sort, right? The big eat the small, the fast eat the slow. You have certain seminaries that are really growing and gaining and others that are decreasing. Even though that's what the stats show, it's still surprising that TEDS is a casualty here because for years it has been among the most influential seminaries in America. And because I'm a history nerd, we're going to go into a little backstory here of seminaries in America because I can't talk about a story like this without doing a little 20th century history lesson. There's some fascinating backstory here to how these institutions got created. And I personally am sad by their demise because I think it betrays a lack of certain kinds of leadership right now in American Christianity. So let's dial back to the 1920s roughly. In the 1920s, you have what is known as the fundamentalist modernist split in American Christianity. So you had the fundamentalists who are very committed to the authority of the scripture, and you had the modernists who are mainly influenced by sort of Darwinism and German higher criticism who are like, you know what, let's keep the Sermon on the Mount, but let's throw out the miracles. We don't know if Jesus rose from the dead. We don't need to care about all that orthodoxy stuff. our job is to sort of accommodate to where the culture is. So you saw this split in almost every denomination in the 1920s. There was a fundamentalist faction and a modernist faction. And what happened was that the modernists controlled all the institutions. So think of schools like Princeton Theological Seminary, Harvard Divinity School, Yale, Duke. The modernists sort of won control for all the institutions. The major storyline here that is interesting to read if you haven't researched it is J. Gresham Machen, who left Princeton Seminary in 1929 with a few other scholars to go found Westminster Theological Seminary because they wanted to. He would not have called himself a fundamentalist, but he did write a book called Christianity and Liberalism, where he argued that the liberals had actually abandoned Christianity because they were trying to call him a fundamentalist and say, of course you want to leave because you're one of those fundies. And he was like, no, I'm just a Christian and you're not. So anyway, all that to say that the institutional weight all shifted to sort of the modernist side of things. And the people who really believed in the authority of the Word of God and the gospel and traditional Christianity were left really without major institutions in North America. What happened is, especially in the Midwest, you saw the fundamentalists created all these little Bible institutes, which were like these little two-year schools. They weren't accredited. There were places you could go to study the Bible and get a Bible degree. And in fact, if you wanted to train to be a pastor, they would equip you to be a pastor. Now, they weren't, you know, they didn't have accreditation. You weren't going to get a fancy degree. But what they did do was to teach the Bible. And so all over our part of the country, in South Dakota, there was a little school called the Prairie Bible Institute that a bunch of my friends used to go to for like this two-year, you know, immersion. Grace College of the Bible, which used to be here in Omaha, started out as Grace Bible Institute, and it was just a little school to try to train people in the Bible. So the institutions that had sort of intellectual credibility all became modernist. The fundamentalists started these little Bible colleges. And then, fascinating story, World War II breaks out. Most of the college and seminary-aged young men in America go to fight in the war. So Harvard Divinity School, Boston University, places on the East Coast that had large endowments and that were wanting to keep training students, suddenly had a bunch of openings in their student body. And Owen Strahan tells this story in his book, Awakening the Evangelical Mind. It's a fascinating story. Basically, a bunch of conservative Christians applied to Harvard Divinity School and got accepted because Harvard needed students. And it turned out they were really good scholars. Mm. And so they really impressed the faculty at Harvard. They all got PhDs there. Among these people are Carl Henry, John Gerstner, Kenneth Cancer, Edward John Carnell, George Eldon Ladd, and a bunch more who all sort of ended up in Boston as conservative Christians, getting PhDs at places like Harvard and Boston U. And most of them went to Park Street Church in Boston, where Harold Auchengay was the preacher. And Auchengay was a hugely influential pastor to all these young students who were studying Semitic languages or studying archaeology or studying New Testament at Harvard. And so Auchengay just basically preached the gospel in the Park Street Church pulpit and had this amazing influence on all of these young scholars. So all of that, then the war ended. But by the time the war ended, most of these guys had graduated. And so they were on now with PhDs to go get teaching posts at various places across the United States. And so what happened is, this is the genius of mid-20th century evangelicalism. You had Billy Graham, you had Carl Henry, you had Harold Auchengay. And by the way, if you've ever heard Tim Keller talk about where he learned to preach, what he will say is he listened to Harold John Auchengay from Park Street in Boston. He listened to Dick Lucas and Martin Lloyd-Jones from London. And those were the guys that taught him how to preach to a skeptical culture. So he will say that over and over again. But anyways, these guys started founding institutions. And here are three of the institutions they founded. Fuller Seminary, Pasadena, California, founded by Carl Henry, Harold Auchengay, and radio evangelist Charles Fuller. The Evangelical Theological Society. Christianity Today, founded by Billy Graham and Carl Henry in 1956. And then Kenneth Cancer, one of those degree-earning intellectuals, established Trinity Evangelical Divinity School in Deerfield, Illinois in 1963. And then in 1969, Gordon Conwell is founded in Boston by the efforts of Billy Graham, Harold Ockingay and J. Howard Pugh, who's a benefactor and funder. So what you have by 1970 is all of these institutions have been built by sort of, they called themselves the evangelicals because they didn't want to be associated with fundamentalism, but they were conservative, Bible-believing, highly intellectual, trained scholars who said, hey, Christianity is going to need seminaries and graduate schools and training centers. And so they built much of what we know today as major seminaries in America were sort of shaped by these leaders in the 1950s and 60s. And one of those is TEDS and Kenneth Cancer, who was one of those people who had gotten a PhD in Boston, served as its dean, as Chris read earlier, until 1978. So Northern evangelicalism, if you want to think about it, is like from Pasadena through Chicago over to Boston. It's sort of that swath of the country. That's the evangelical center of America. Now, what's funny is if you ask people today, Chris, what's the center of evangelicalism in America? What would you say?
I would think of places like, I mean, South, somewhere in the South. So like maybe Southern Seminary,
yeah.
Southern Baptist Convention.
Yeah. I think that's what most, in fact, you know, when we did that podcast a few weeks ago, by the way, friends, Dusty White just showed up.
Hey, hey.
He came in late to this podcast.
It was like Jesus just appeared among them. You just appeared among us.
When we did a podcast a few weeks ago on the major denominations from the Pew Religious Landscape Study, we said Southern Baptist is the largest Protestant denomination in North America. So yeah, when most people think like, where's the power center and the sort of institutional weight of evangelical Christianity in America, most people would say Southern Baptist. But that is a new thing. That was not the case in the 1970s. In the 1970s, you would have said Fuller Seminary or Talbot or Trinity or, you know, Boston with Gordon Conwell. So what happened was, this is a fascinating shift. What I want to argue, and I'm going to stop here so we can just discuss the takeaways, but here's what I think is interesting. What happened in 19... So Kenneth Cancer stepped down as dean at TEDS in 1978. In 1979, a group of Southern Baptist leaders began to discuss how they could shift the nation's largest Protestant denomination, the Southern Baptists, in a more conservative direction. And that began with the election in 1979 of Adrian Rogers as the president of the Southern Baptist Convention. But really, the key moment in all of that is 1993, when a young man named Albert Mohler becomes the president at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. If you've never heard this story, you should go look it up because it's fascinating. Basically, Mohler gets installed with the mandate to turn this seminary into an evangelical powerhouse for scholarship and for Christian thought. And so basically he cleans house, fires a bunch of liberal professors who weren't affirming the statement of faith. And what he started to do, Chris, is he started to hire a bunch of professors who had graduated from where?
TEDS.
TEDS. He hired some folks like Greg Allison and Tom Nettles and Bruce Ware, who had all graduated from TEDS. And he started to build a robust faculty at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville. And so my argument, by the way, here's a quote from an article by Colin Hansen. He writes, anyone who attends the meetings of the Evangelical Theological Society or browses book catalogs from evangelical publishers knows how much power and influence Southern Baptists wield among their born-again peers. And it's not just SBTS any longer. This year, Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary in Kansas City celebrated its 12th consecutive year of record enrollment and has surpassed SBTS for the most full-time equivalent students with 1,862. Another writer at Religion News Service says, most of the power in evangelicalism has shifted to the South. Baptist seminaries dominate modern theological education with nearly 20,000 students enrolled in the 6 seminaries run by the Southern Baptist Convention or at Liberty University. That's more than a quarter of the seminary students in the U.S. And by the way, what happened at Midwestern, Al Mohler gets credit for, because guess who Jason Allen was the assistant to before he took over as the president of Midwestern?
Right.
He worked for Al Mohler. So basically, I am convinced as I read this article, number one, sad that Ted's is falling apart or that it's closing its doors in Chicago. But the thing that impresses me more is almost everything that's happened in the last 30 years of theological education is due to the work and leadership of Albert Mohler, who literally rebuilt Southern Baptist theological education from the ground up in a way that it has transformed the seminary experience in America. I mean, that article just said a quarter of the students in America who are in seminary go to a Southern Baptist seminary.
It is fascinating at the historical level. I there's bits and pieces of this that I knew, but you know, putting this all together, I hadn't seen this whole picture. And so the thought that it seems as if this previous generation of institutions, so you have Ted's, you have, I don't know, you know, Fuller, Gordon Conwell, are starting to struggle in some particular ways that either they're going to course correct and get stable again, or there's going to be a ginormous gap here. And you say, well, the Southern Baptist seminaries are, you know, hey, Southern Baptist seminaries, great, awesome. But that's not going to be sufficient.
Right. It's not where we went, Chris.
Yeah.
It's
not. on purpose. But so there is a powerful statement here about the importance of institutions. And a big question is, hey, these formative institutions, these influential institutions, now that they seem to be struggling, either they're going to close or they're going to be on life support and not have the same influence. What's going to fill in the gap? What is this generation of Christians doing? Where are the future Al Mohlers beyond just the SBC? It's a fascinating question for our time.
To be clear, I want to celebrate the thriving of Southern Baptist seminaries. I think by and large, they are wonderful theological institutions. They are all connected to the Southern Baptist world in ways that we are not. Yes. And so if you're not a Southern Baptist, attending a Southern Baptist seminary can be kind of an interesting experience because a lot of the things that they are inculcating and caring about have to do with Southern Baptist polity, Southern Baptist history, Southern Baptist institutions. And it's fascinating to me as I think about what you just said, Chris. What I will tell you is that Southern Baptists, there is an institutional spirit in Southern Baptist life that can be some of the most dysfunctional, ugly stuff in the world, but that also is probably the reason why they have robust seminaries. Mm-hmm. Because Southern Baptists do a good job thinking about the institutional leadership of the church. They care about polity. You know, if you've ever been in a Southern Baptist church, there's a committee for everything and you got to run it by that committee. I mean, they're organized in a way that does give institutional strength.
Yeah. And they incentivize going to Southern Baptist seminaries and Southern Baptist schools. And so they're reinforcing the institution by incentivizing going there. And I think that's an important thing. They're literally putting their money where their mouth is to build these institutions.
Which is, I suspect, the thing that Ted's was not doing well. Meaning Ted's was connected to the Evangelical Free Church in America, but whereas in the Southern Baptist world, there is a whole sort of set of policies by which churches fund seminaries. The Free Church world didn't have that. The nature of a free church, if you're not familiar with sort of the name of that denomination, is that it's a free church. It's an association. We join together for the sake of mission, but each church is free and independent. And so, Dusty, you can't tell me that I got to give 2% to the denominational seminary, because at the end of the day, I can't, if our church decides to, we can, but there's not a mandate. And so it is interesting that the question of how do you prop up and continue the support of an institution like a seminary, that question is not as clear in a free church tradition as it is in a Southern Baptist tradition.
There's also probably a piece of the models of education here. So you think of like Liberty, they're not connected to a denomination or a convention, but they have grown largely through, so correct me if I'm wrong here, but from my understanding, largely through the strength of their forward thinking about delivering, you know, their online programs and distance education. I mean, Mindy got her master's in counseling from there, you know, so 20 some years ago, and she would get like CDs in the mail and like, you know, the old school kind of distance, but they were like pioneering that stuff. And I think there's also probably a part of the story is which seminaries are forward thinking in their models and which kind of held to a traditional, because if you're like, hey, you have to be on campus, you have to move to Chicago or have to move to such and such location, that's just not going to cut it in today's world. And so there's probably some of that too, of how the seminaries that thought, hey, how is education, how are people going to engage education? Are there models of, and flexibility that we can have that could also help us keep students?
I suspect you're right, but I would push back on that in the sense that I think it's also a mistake for seminaries to go all in on the distance ed revolution.
Agree.
I think that actually residential experience at a seminary ought to be a really high value. And so, but I do think it's interesting to think about how do you deliver a modular online course that allows a person to work a job at UPS and get a seminary degree, and also invite Chris Hellman to move to Chicago if he wants to and be a student here. Yeah. I mean, you do have to kind of do both.
Yeah.
But I think it's hard for seminaries to figure out how do we do both well.
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair point in the sense of you can sacrifice some really good things if you just, you know, hey, we need to get students, so let's do whatever we can. You can lose some things there too.
It is interesting that Midwestern is celebrating full-time record still, but they also were innovating a lot of church partnership with distance learning along the way. So to your comment earlier, Bob, about like the organization and you know, like when you think Southern Baptist, you think a little bit of like old school, almost crotchety committee stuff, but still on the cutting edge of some of that technological distance stuff. So that is actually interesting that they're leading in that way while still maintaining the structure.
I love me some Midwestern seminary. Also, they rebuild everything every 2 years. And so I have some heartburn there because it's like we were in their church. We literally had this happen to us, to one of our staff members here, who we were in a church partnership program with Midwestern where they gave members of Quorumdeo a tuition discount. And the page was still up on their website. But when he called the office to get the discount, they were like, yeah, we don't do that anymore. And he was like, well, I'm looking at the page on your website that says you do. And so he literally had to like file an appeal with the school and say, because they had discontinued the program, but they hadn't put it up on the website yet. So he was like, actually, your website says you have to honor this tuition discount.
Wow.
And they were like, well, we don't do that anymore.
Tell the IT guys.
Seriously. But all that to say, they have been innovating quickly. And I think part of that happens when you're innovating quickly is like, oh yeah, we didn't update the web page in the right way. I am concerned that one thing you have to say about TEDS, Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, is that it, in its heyday, I think probably shaped more of global Christianity than almost any other institution. If you just think about the weight of D.A. Carson's scholarship, the man has published, I think, over 50 books, most of them academic tomes having to do with the New Testament. He's shaped global Christianity in significant ways. Likewise, Kevin Van Hooser. Those two profs are going to be sorely missed in Christianity. Now, I'm sure Carson's already retired, and I'm sure Van Hooser will land on his feet either moving to Canada with Trinity or maybe he'll end up somewhere else.
SBC.
But either way.
He'll be in Kansas City next week.
Maybe so. But those scholars are going to continue doing their work. What I am jealous for in American Christianity is the life of the mind being valued in ways that allows these institutions to continue to function. I do think there's something beautiful about people doing academic work in a way that's focused and in a way that does train pastors, but that also is engaging with the highest academic scholarship. And, you know, in all the stuff we've done here, Dusty, from Porterbrook to Equip and so forth, you know, all of our modular training programs that we've run at Quorumdeo, they're great for equipping Christians for leadership. They don't have that academic heft, you know, of a high research level seminary degree. And I think that is good for the church, good for Christianity, and good for our influence and culture when we have people working at that level. And I'm sad that we won't have that just down the road in Chicago anymore once TEDS closes. I had put out on Twitter yesterday that we were going to be talking about this topic, and I got a bunch of responses from TEDS students and from some Southern Baptist students who offered various commentary. In some of the crowdsourcing out there, I know Twitter is Twitter, so you can't count on everything, but a lot of what was said was TEDS had great faculty and intellectual strength, but poor institutional leadership, poor organizational strength. So they had faculty like Kevin Van Hooser, who is like top shelf academic mind, but their organizational leadership was not as strong. And so you ended up having, you know, this is what always happens that kills institutions is you have people there who really want to serve the cause. It's just, if you don't have good organizational leadership, that thing can fall apart pretty quickly. We've seen that with all the colleges in our own city that have closed over the last decade.
Yeah, because you're usually hiring a professor that ends up leading the thing. And so it's really hard to find an organizational leader who's also been in the classroom that can still lead the bigger deal.
Colin Hanson autobiographically talks about, he wrote a little sort of a eulogy to Ted's at TGC a couple weeks ago. He writes this: at least 8 of my friends from undergrad went on to seminary. 4 chose Ted's, 4 others chose SBTS, Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville. I asked the Ted's admissions staffer how they attracted students who were choosing between the two schools. Backed by the cooperative program of the Southern Baptist Convention, SBTS offered much lower tuition then and now. The TED's admissions officer said they didn't know many students looking at SBTS. That's when I knew TED's was in trouble. And his point is, if you're not competing to get students, then, and you don't even know that students are looking at other places, that's probably not a good sign. Mm-hmm. And there was probably a little bit of passivity there in terms of how TED was, the pipeline they were building of how students were going to find them. And the bad news of not building that pipeline is that the pipeline runs dry and you didn't realize that there was nothing in there.
Well, and you probably get more of this, both of you, but I get personal emails from Midwestern saying, hey, we're sending a guy up there. Hey, mm-hmm. Dusty, yeah. And I'm like, wait, this is an actual person sending me this email, trying to get lunch, get coffee, create a cohort of people trying to do some recruiting for their school.
Yeah. Well, I get super nerdy about the history of evangelical institutions. And so thank you, listeners, for sort of enjoying this journey with me down memory lane of the 20th century. But I do think there is much for us to learn here. And I want to just close with a couple reflections. One is the question, what is our generation or the generation even behind mine going to do to create or sustain good institutions? I think we need to ask that question. And then second, how should we feel about ongoing theological education? If it's not going to be at a residential seminary in Chicago, what is our method and means for ensuring good theological education in the church? Whether it is a seminary like TED's or some other model, we certainly need to not give up on the importance of theological education and training for pastors. And I want to encourage listeners who have agency in these areas. Some of you listeners are local church leaders. Some of you are people aspiring to ministry. Some of you might be in seminary right now. I want to encourage you to think about how can we take initiative to step into these gaps and create some new things and solve some of these problems. It's important for us to continue to train leaders for the next generation. And TED's did a great job of that for a long time. And it's sad to see that institution decline, but we trust that God will raise up others in its place.
The goal of this podcast is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or a church leader in another context, thank you for listening in. We pray that this conversation might be helpful to you as you minister in your context. We always love to hear from listeners. So if you have thoughts, questions, or future podcast topics, send an email to podcast@cityomaha.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time for another episode of the Wednesday Conversation.